Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for November 23rd, 2023, Thanksgiving. And tonight I'm having, again, my Thanksgiving special. Now, this show has been airing for 23 years, kind of a golden anniversary, if you want to call it that, on the 23rd of November 2023. All of these dates lining up. But many times there are avid listeners to my show, and then on Thanksgiving there are people who are visiting for Thanksgiving, these other people who listen to my show, who have never heard me before. So I typically give a special set of topics for this Thanksgiving day. And first of all, to be thankful for everything that we have. If you're attending a big Thanksgiving feast or supper, then you are one of the lucky peoples around the world, and that's what Thanksgiving is all about, that you work hard, you play hard, you do everything that you can do to make life better. And let's face it, the majority of people, the one main thing that they work on every day is their family. And this show has always been a family show. It's to the kids, to the parents, and educating people about things that they thought they knew were true, but really, after studying this, spending my life, 25 years in the telecommunication industry, and about 10 years of my life teaching at the university level physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy, I've come to learn that a lot of what we think we know is really completely bogus and off the wall untrue. So tonight I want to concentrate on a few things, and this is an interesting question that just came up because we're heading into the Christmas season. And by the way, these holidays are Christian, based on the Christian country that was developed here. It's changing rapidly. It's being decimated, the family, the Christian heritage, etc., and all of the hard work that went into building this country. Sometimes you hear the word privilege. Well, privilege is not something that's simply granted, like some magic hand comes down from below, but it's earned through generations of hard work, thoughtfulness, and taking care of your kids. Because if you improve your life, improve the life of others, then that builds a better life for the future, and that's what it's all about. So while other places, the people were throwing sand at each other and fighting, or the United States was developing a very superior culture. And there's bad aspects to this too. The war machines, the infiltration of other countries for resources, sure, there's some bad things. But what we're here today is to give thanks for what we have, and to also understand the need for generosity. So anyway, with those thoughts, I wanted to branch into something. Now, we're heading into the Christmas season, and this came up on a radio show where I was guest a couple weeks ago, about the Magi, these three kings. We call them, in fact, the holiday is called the Holiday of the Three Kings. And a big part, a really big, big part of the Christmas story, the birth of Christ, the nativity, the birth is preempted by the three magi, the three kings. And what were they doing? They were watchers of the sky. They were independent. These guys did not know each other, but they came from a long line of what we today, it's really, I think, an improper word. Some people might say astrology, which has a lot of bad connotations. Astrology, a lot of people think of, oh, that's voodoo science or whatever. But the Bible is very clear that these people were looking for signs in the heavens. And these signs had been predicted thousands of years earlier. So generations came and generations went without this sign appearing in the heaven. Well, what was it? We're really not told. But my belief is, my personal belief, being an astronomer, a space scientist, astrophysicist, whatever you may want to call it, is that it was a comet, a very special comet, possibly one with, say, three nuclei, something that was extremely rare. And but anyway, that's neither here nor there. What it was, the sign in the heavens? Well, it was there and was up in the sky and was there for a very long time. And before Christmas, I typically give a lecture on the Christmas star, a full-blown lecture. But tonight I want to talk just about the three magi, and what did they see, and what were the characteristics, and where did they get this information that they were looking for this symbol in the heavens. So going back literally thousands of years, there was a promise that was made to the Israelites, Abraham, that went on down, that there would be a Messiah or Savior, and that there would be certain signs in the heavens that would preclude the birth of this Messiah, and the Messiah would come and radically change everything on earth. And that certainly did happen. I mean, it's the calendar we use, everything was based on the birth of Christ. So that's a huge event in history. And the United States was based on Christian values. That's why the United States is the mecca for free speech, for freedom, although those freedoms are being eroded every day on a daily basis. The sign in the heavens was something very special. And I want to reiterate a couple very important parts of this story, the Magi story, is that there were three kings. There wasn't one, there wasn't two, but three independent. And this is, if you're doing something in, say, the science world, and you make a claim of some kind of scientific discovery, the real proof of that in the scientific sense is you have a third-party independent verification of that scientific proof. And if it doesn't have that, then it's a scientific claim, but it's only by the claimant, not by other independent people. And so the idea that there were three independent verification of these three magi, like I say, they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have telecommunications, they didn't have satellite links or the internet, they didn't have automobiles, there was no type of instant communication, but they all at the very same time recognized that this sign in the heavens was the one that had been expected for thousands of years. So a very important event. And when it happened, they immediately, all three of them independently, started packing their bags. And this is an indication that this sign in the heavens lasted a long time. Now, they discovered it in the east, but they followed it to the west. Very important part of this story, because that's typical of celestial objects that come into the solar system. So there's something coming into the solar system that was discovered in the east and then went around behind the sun, and when they followed it to the west, and it came to sit above the place where Christ was born. But remember, this is back in the day when they had camels. They arrived on camels in this little town in the Mideast, and the birthplace, and it took them literally years of preparation. This is the point. Three independent people taking years to pack their bags, get their entourage ready. It wasn't like they had instant access to highways, super highways, and no, this was slow. A camel train can maybe go 10 to 15 miles per day and crossing literally maybe 800, 1,000 miles open territory. And they meet on the way. One meets the other one, then the other one, and they're all seeing this sign in the heavens, following it, so they go together. But this is a process that takes years. So this is before Christ is born, because they arrive at the time of the birth. They didn't just pack their bags and just run across the desert in an afternoon. this took a lot of time. So this was preparation time, and so that's why the part of the nativity story, why the one of the most important parts is the story of the three magi. Three independent verification in the scientific sense, that's triple the validity that would be required for any major scientific discovery. And we know who these guys were. We know we have a historical record. They were independent people, independent of the Christ birth situation or whatever. And who were the other people at the birth? The shepherd boy, the animals. It was a very simple event. But then all of a sudden, at the time of the birth, within a day, these three kings show up bearing gifts of frankincense, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And these were very, very valuable gifts that they brought with them. In the day, it would have been like bringing a check for $100,000 each one. So being born out in this stable in the middle of the country, in the middle of winter, a cold winter's night, probably snow, clear blue sky if you've ever been in a cold area where it's a very cold winter night and all of the stars are shining in its glory. And back in those days there were no street lights. So the sky is ablaze with stars. And this special star comes and points down right above the birthplace of Christ. And the kings stop and they go in. And remember, this is an interesting part of the story too, is on their journeying, they stop and they talk to Herod, the ruler of that area for the Roman Empire. And Herod has seen the sign. His astrologers or astronomers, whatever you want to call them, have seen the sign too, which is an indication that they knew that the Messiah had been born or was about to be born also. And so Herod tells the three kings, he says, "Hey, you guys go find him. And when you find him, come back and tell me where he is." And the three kings go, well, they didn't trust Herod, obviously, being three kings, wise men as they were, obviously knew that Herod had bad intentions. So when they returned to their homeland, they followed a different route. This is all in the scriptures. It's very interesting. So the three kings were not the only guys that saw this sign in the heaven and knew what it was, that the birth of the Messiah has finally was nigh, was upon us. And okay, so the three kings go visit, they give their gifts, and they return back to their homeland by a different route, so that they did not inform Herod. So eventually, probably Herod wakes up and goes, "Hey, these three king guys didn't come back and tell me." But he was a bit powerless over the three kings who went back to their own homeland, far to the east, once again indicating the difference. If it were in a modern day, Herod would have sent the boys out to track down the three kings and say, "Okay, where did you find this kid?" But anyway, the story goes on, and eventually, of course, I'm not going to go through all of the scriptures and what happened, but the three kings are an instrumental part of this story because, in the scientific sense, as a scientist, as an engineer, if you have independent verification, excuse me, of one party, that is reliable. Now, the three kings, the three wise men, would any one of them by themselves would be considered a reliable person, a reliable source. But three of them, with the corroborating story of them meeting up and everything else, of meeting Herod, these are real people. These are real characters in real history. But three of them independently verifying the birth of Christ is like the gold standard, the platinum standard for verifying an event. So the three kings, and the Feast of Three Kings, of course, is coming up, is an essential part of this story. And a lot of people don't realize this. A lot of people think, oh, the three kings, they came, gave their gifts and left. But the whole scenario of from the beginning, from when they saw the sign in the heaven, packed their bags independently and then met on the way, is a very, very important part of this story because of simply because of the need for scientific verification of the story. And it's not like this is the other thing. It's not like somebody would make this up. And I've seen people who try and diminish the value of Christ and the Christmas story, like, oh, they just made all this stuff up. No, these are historical people. These are historical events. And it is recorded in the Bible, of course, but it's recorded elsewhere also. And so the once again the three magi, very important. But then the other thing I wanted to talk about was, where did these three wise men get their information? So, and Herod knew this too, by the way. Herod knew, Herod saw the sign in heaven, knew what it meant. And so the intelligent world at that time was tuned to the fact that this sign, which had been expected for thousands of years, the intelligent people of that era knew what that sign was, and it happened. And so we're living in a time now, too, where people say, oh, there's certain signs in the heavens, etc. I don't see any myself right now for any major events going on. But the point is that back in those days, there was no TV, there was no internet, there were no cell phones. So people, what did they spend their interest? The intelligent people, they spent their time looking at the heavens. That was their TV, the movement of the stars and the planets, and understanding the value in this. There are a lot of people who criticize the idea of astrology, and astrology has literally been made into somewhat of a crazy science, which, you see the, next to Ann Landers in the newspaper, the astrology forecast for today, what's your sign, what's going to happen today. And it's almost like a computer generates this stuff to print in the newspaper every day. And, that's not what I'm talking about. Not at all. What I'm talking about are these historical events that were predicted thousands of years earlier that came to pass, and very unusual events. So what the other thing that happens is, and I'll be giving a full lecture on this in upcoming weeks on the Christmas star, is astronomers who are mainly atheists try and say, oh, the Christmas star was just a planetary alignment, but no, planetary alignments only last for a few hours. They're there one night, they're not there the next night. They don't even last a day. So a planetary alignment could not have been the Christmas star. No way. And so there's all of these other suggestions that there was a supernova, which again maybe lasts, an afternoon, and a star explodes, and then forms this nebular cloud around it over time. But the actual explosion is very short-lived. And so once again, doesn't fit in into the category of a Christmas star that has to last literally years in the heavens. And so we have had comets, for example. If you look at a comet, I'm not going to name any particular, but some of them will be up there for many years at a time. But they're not unusual comets, they're just regular comets. But anyway, the thing about a comet is that it's something that comes into the solar system. Some of them only last a short amount of time, a few days. Most comets are very short-lived. They're only visible, even with telescopes, for a day or two or a week maybe, and then they're gone, or they lose their luma, so they're not visible anymore. But for a comet to be visible in bright sky, and unusual to the form of whatever it was, to be visible for that period of time, very visible to the people. And of course, these people are traveling in desert conditions, so every night you have that big bright object up in the sky. They discovered it to the east and followed it to the west. Now, once again, I'll repeat how this happens. When an object, let's take Venus as a great example, it can be the morning star or it can be the evening star. if it's in the morning star, it's in the east. If it's the evening star, it's in the west. That's a perfect example. Now, Venus is a planet going around the sun, but it's a perfect example of an object that goes around behind the sun, not visible for that period of time, and then it comes out on the other side. So it alternates between the morning star and the evening star, between the east and the west. And so it's a perfect example of an object in the sky that does this little change that they talk about with the Christmas star. So all of these subtle hints, if you understand astronomy, are very essential to understanding the story. Now the next aspect to talk about is the fact that these guys were kings. And when you think of kings and royalty, now here's another point. In their land, they were top dog. They were top man on the heap. They were the kings. They were in charge of their domain. And they all were humbled by the fact, and they took the most precious gifts that they could afford. Physical gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And this is very important, too, because just a very interesting few facts about Mary, the mother, is that she was not some poor little pauper girl living out in the desert someplace. Her uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, was undoubtedly one of the richest, if not the richest man in all of Rome. Joseph of Arimathea was a very wealthy businessman who traveled. He had mines in England, what we now call England, in Brittany. And he would bring the metal. There was no metals that were known about, metal deposits, in the Roman Empire. So the good metal came from England, what we now call England. And he brought it on boats. Now, this is enough to supply the Roman army. Now, imagine today someone who supplies, say, iron to the U.S. military. This was the equivalent back in the Roman days. And Joseph of Arimathea was the guy that had the contract, because he could get into Brittany, because he was basically an Israelite. He was, heritage was from the group of people that were occupying Brittany at the time, the islands, the English islands. So he could get in there, but the Roman army could not. The Roman army, it took them hundreds and hundreds of years before they could actually invade and penetrate the British islands. It took them a long time, and even at that, they were very unsuccessful. But this is back in the days before Christ was born. Joseph of Arimathea was a very wealthy man. He had a very extensive library. We know quite a bit about this guy. And he was the guy, by the way, who took the body of Christ after the crucifixion, Joseph of Arimathea. He weaves in and out of these stories and clearly had a great influence on Christ's life when Christ was being raised. He took Christ under his wing, and that's why he was at the crucifixion to take the body, because it had to be somebody legally of the family to claim the body after the crucifixion, which was Joseph of Arimathea. And so this guy is Mary's uncle, a very wealthy guy. So like I say, she was not some pauper girl living out in the desert somewhere. Mary was in a family, one of the richest families in all of Rome. However, lived in this little hamlet region over in what we now call the Mideast. But Joseph of Arimathea spent a lot of time there. He was also in Rome. He was in England. He was in other parts of the known world at that time. He traveled a lot. And so that's another part of the story. So when the kings came, back to the three magi, when the three kings showed up at the birthplace, they are bringing the most valuable gifts that they could bring. A cask that was brought on a camel full of gold. You can imagine if somebody walked up to you today with this box that a camel could carry, probably maybe a half a ton of gold. I mean, a valuable gift. Frankincense and myrrh, also extremely valuable gifts, worth a lot of money in that time. And so they lived a very humble life. Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus growing up lived a very humble life. And remember, they had to go to Egypt for part of his youth because of escaping the purge of the young males at the time, trying to basically kill this Messiah baby. And so they went to Egypt and they spent a lot of time there. And a lot of this history is unclear. We just have bits and pieces of it. But the point is that the three magi, bringing the most valuable gifts that they could give, showing that they were humbled by this Messiah, the birth of this Messiah. And they put a lot of value, let's put it that way, because they were giving earthly gifts. But being kings, that was the most valuable gift they had. So imagine they had to cross this desert, which was ripe with thieves and charlatans, carrying these extremely valuable gifts. So they weren't just traveling by themselves. They were with an entourage, plus probably a small army. And you had to support all of these people on the trip. So they had to carry all their goods, their food. This was not a small operation. This was not a small undertaking. You have the image of the three kings, and they're at the nativity scene, or they're crossing. You show the three camels with the three kings riding each respective camel. But no, these guys had to have a serious entourage of people just carrying the goods that they needed and the protection they needed to cross the desert. And hundreds of miles in a very long time, months worth of supplies. This was not a small operation by any means. And so I think that a lot of this is lost. The perspective of this is lost when we have the season of the three kings. We just imagine these three guys jumping on their camel and riding across the desert with a little box of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. No. This was a big, big time operation for each one of these. And then they meet together and for protection, and that's very common back in the old days, is that you would travel together for protection. Because, like I say, out in the middle of the desert, there's no policeman, there's no 911 number to call. You're on your own in foreign countries where you got this kingly robes on and you have all this, wealth, and you have people out there who would cut your throat for a penny. Yeah, and they're traveling with this extremely valuable cargo, and they all make it there, of course. So this is just an indication, and I think a lot of this is lost in the telling of the story, which is the nativity, the Christmas story is one of the most beautiful stories in all the history of man. And the whole life of Christ, etc. But the United States was built on Christian values, and I think also have to realize that there's a lot of charity needed in the world today. But so when giving thanks on Thanksgiving Day, hopefully we can put all of this into perspective. Part of giving thanks is saying thank you for everything we have, but understanding also the necessity in the world that is present. And 50% of the people in the world without running water, with even the basic essentials of life. Anyway, the world today is, I'm not going to get into that because it's a holiday, a time for laughter and being friendly, but also a time to just be thankful. Thankful for what we've got, thankful for the opportunities that are here. And also thankful, I think this is forgotten a lot of times, thankful for all the people that came before who built this amazing structure that we live in. When you go out and you get in your car and you turn it on, I mean, the automobiles being built today are very reliable. You just turn the key, you don't think about having flat tires. Some guy had to invent the material that the tires are made out of to make them really strong. Back when I was young, it was very common to have a flat tire or two along the way. We went on a trip, you would be expected that you would have to get out and change the flat tire and fix it on the roadside, maybe in the rain, a couple times during a trip, because the tires, they were okay, but they weren't the quality that we have today, or the engines, you know, they the cars just didn't last as long. They were not as reliable. But today, you know, as long as you do some maintenance on a car, they're going to run for a very long time, trouble-free. You get on a freeway, everybody's going 70 miles an hour, and the reliability of the cars is there. But what is, you know, this is what I'm talking about, being thankful for all those people that spent their lives, you know, improving, improving, improving to the point where we have this lifestyle that we have today. But the rest of the world is not like that. I had a comment, a young person once said that they had an aunt that was very well traveled, had been to Mexico, to all these other countries, and the realization was that the aunt had only been to five-star hotels. And so, you know, that's not traveling to a foreign country. That's just like living in New York City, but in another country with all the amenities. In fact, the amenity is probably much nicer than your own home locations. But not having any understanding that down the street, a couple miles away, there were very poor people that had almost nothing in their lives, or living out in the country, that had very poor sanitary conditions or very poor food supply. While the opulence in the five-star hotel is like all of these different, you know, the breakfast buffet filled with all of the best cooked, you know, food in the world. And you could select from what you wanted, and there was abundance beyond. If you took something, someone would be right there to replace it. And not understanding, this is the problem, that not understanding that down the street and down the block and out in the countryside, there are people who literally have nothing. So being well traveled is a relative term, is what I'm saying. But there again, that's not to make anybody feel guilty. It's just that our ancestors, the people that came before us, spent their lives building what we sit on today. And for that, I'm saying be thankful. Because this was a country built on progress, on building quality, and that's why we have the situation we have today. Because a lot of people spent their lives working very diligently so their families would have a better life. And I think that's the key phrase, and the thing that most people are doing today, is that they're working hard so their kids will have at least as good a life as they are having. And I don't think there's a lot of people who want a better life, just an equal life. And so they're working hard every day. They work hard to make sure their family is well taken care of. And that's the core unit, is the family, where the parents work, it's a coordination of efforts on the part of the family, you know, the kids growing up, learning responsibility, and moving out into become responsible elements in the society. Everybody doing their part to make this big machine that we call society work. And so anyway, to be thankful for that, all those generations that came before, imagine the people crossing the Great Plains in covered wagons. A lot of people, there are a lot of people made it, but a lot of people didn't make it because the conditions were so harsh. These were very tough, rugged people. And on their shoulders, everybody sits today. Okay, changing gears a little bit here. I want to talk about what I term, the terms I defined, They are tier one, tier two, tier three science. Well, what does that mean? What is the real structure of the scientific world that surrounds us and that we see or study in school or whatever? And it's a very interesting situation. It's something I discovered because I lived in this. I have a master's degree in physics, nuclear and solid state physics. I have a very extensive mathematics background. I taught physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy at the university level for about 10 years, and I spent about 25 years of my life in high security positions in the telecommunications industry as an engineer. So it's something that I understand quite well as telecommunications and communication protocols and encryption and things like that. But what I learned in my time, in fact, I've probably been at some of the best locations in the world in terms of universities. But what I learned is that there's something that I call tier one science. This is the science you never see. You never see the names of the scientists. They don't publish papers in peer-reviewed journals. They're simply invisible. They might be the guy living next door or down the street, somebody you see in church on Sunday, or somebody that it's hard to say, that these people are there. But the science and engineering that they do is simply at a level that is hidden from the public. Sometimes I call it military science, but that's not an absolutely correct word either. Then you see the public science. That's what you see, for example, it might be scientists that work at NASA, at JPL or Goddard, and there may be a mixture. There might be some of the people working right next to another person at these locations. And there you have tier one scientists. And the situation is, let me go historically how some of this develops. Student is going through university, physics, engineering, math, whatever it is, and they somehow have certain properties. And they're very specific properties. For example, I once was a friend of mine, John Moore, he's got a talk show host, and I'm a guest there every week on his radio show, but he was a Green Beret. In the military, a couple stints in Vietnam, he was had earned the Green Beret status. And so he was talking about what it takes to become a Green Beret. And so he said, never in the time he was in the Green Berets, Special Forces, did he ever see anybody that looked like Rambo. Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger with the big arm, the big gun type of thing. He said he never saw a person like that. There was just this completely muscle guy, and all of this. He said, no, a Green Beret is a lot of it is mental conditioning and things like that. And the people who become Green Berets are a very special breed. And so there's very special things they look for in special forces, and it's not the things that you would think about or that see in the movies. The same situation exists in the sciences, where there are people that have certain properties, and I don't know all of them. I've seen people grow up and go through school, through university, PhD level, and then all of a sudden disappear. And I know were plucked out of the groupings to become tier one scientists, and when they do, they sign a contract. And it's a gag order. It's basically a non-disclosure type of an agreement where they have to they're off the charts. I mean, they're off the record after that. Anything they do, they don't own. They're literally owned by the government agencies or the corporations who are then funded by government agencies that work on special projects. And they cannot walk up to a microphone, they cannot talk about anything that they do. So that is tier one science. The science that you see, people like, say, Carl Sagan, the the Cosmos series, Neil deGrasse Tyson, are Tier 2 or Tier 3 scientists. What is a Tier 2 scientist? Well, they work on government programs also. In fact, literally all scientists work on some kind of government-funded program, whether they're in a private corporation or not. Mostly all of the money somehow comes through some other avenue or whatever from the government, on government projects, etc. And I'm myself an independent scientist. I've worked around government agencies and scientists all my life, but I've never signed any of the contracts. I don't work for them. I don't get money from them. I fund my own research. And I'll go to, say, for example, an American Geophysical Union meeting. 20,000 scientists from around the world gather together to discuss every topic under the sun regarding science. This is all Tier 2 science. Tier 2 meaning the level below Tier 1. These people publish, Tier 2 scientists publish in peer-reviewed journals. They might be in the news media. They might have a project that gets, prizes, or maybe win a Nobel Prize. This is Tier 2 science. If you see it, here's the rule. If you see it, if you see their names, if you see their faces, it's not Tier 1 science. Tier 1 scientists you never, ever see. Here's a good example. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting in one of my specialty areas is solar plasma physics. And so I was in a meeting as in the audience listening to some scientists talk about their work. And they were working on the funding from NASA, dealing with studying for a project studying solar physics. And they said part of their funding requires them to take their information, their findings, and send it up to a certain level. It's just a place where they send it to. They don't know who's there, who receives it. And they said, we send that information there. And somebody in the audience said, well, what did they say back? Did they say it was good? Did they like it? He said, the presenter said, oh, they never respond to us. We don't know. We don't know if they used it, if they liked it, if it was good, if it fit in with what they're doing. They never respond to us. It was a clear indication that this guy knew that there was a level of science above him. Another indication is, say, you're a Tier 2 scientist, you're working at one of the big observatories in the mountaintops, some remote location where there's a big telescope. In the middle of the night, the men in black suits come in. All of the staff has to leave the facility, and somebody gets to use this equipment to do some kind of a project or experiment. And these are, you don't just go and use this equipment and not know about it previously. You have to be very experienced to use modern high-tech astronomy equipment. You have to know what you're doing. But these people will come in, and for that night or a series of nights, all of the projects that people had planned, the scheduling for that telescope time, has been usurped by someone who just comes in out of nowhere and says, okay, now we're going to use this, and you don't get to see who's using it or identify who they are or anything. That's Tier 1 science, and they have programs. For example, about 15 years ago, I was looking at the budget for the Navy. The Navy has a program, $60 billion budget for aerospace procurement. This is the Navy. And the entire NASA annual budget is around a third of that for the entire budget for personnel and everything. So you can see there's a tremendous amount of material of science engineering going on in what we call black ops, or I call it Tier 1 science. Tremendous amount going on that you don't see. The second part of this is that Tier 2 science is what filters down to be in the publications and the textbooks, what they teach the public, the stories on the History Channel or Discovery Channel or other National Geographic specials, etc., with space science. This is the gee whiz science that's pawned off on the public, and it's really intentionally skewed. let's put it that way, or if nothing else, completely corrupted. For example, there's still this story that a comet is a dirty snowball. It's absolutely ludicrous. People have landed on comet nuclei. There's no water, there's no ice. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. The dirty snowball comet model has been thoroughly proven to be false. But the tier two science keeps propounding it as some kind of golden truth. That's an example. That's just a simple example. Or the idea that the universe began in a big bang, or that the solar system began 4.5 billion years ago, and all the planets and all of life evolved out of this, explosion or whatever happened. This is what's pawned off on the public. There's, for example, the Smithsonian Institute. Part of its job is to sequester findings, archaeological findings or anthropological findings, and the good stuff goes up the ladder into tier one archaeology and science, and the kind of the garbage science is then pawned off on the public in museums and things like that. And a lot of people think that rockets are the way to go into space. Well, they're not. That's a way to get heavy items into space, but just going into space is very easy, which we're finding out from people like the Scaled Composites or Richard Branson. When they went into space, they didn't have special space suits. They had like jumpsuits, no helmet, no oxygen mask, just like sitting in your car. And this thing that goes into space and comes back. Not a difficult thing to do, but they make it look like it's really difficult to give people the impression that you need NASA, this national agency with billions of dollars and tens of thousands of scientists and engineers working to get a few people in space every 6 months. That's tier two science. That's tier two science. Okay, so at any rate, what's a tier three scientist? A tier three scientist would be somebody that doesn't do research, that mainly maybe teaches at the university level and teaches out of a textbook, or maybe is a news reporter that takes information that comes from tier two science and puts it in the form of a publication or a news article or a gee whiz, look at this, isn't this special? Report for NASA or whatever. So the tier two science, tier three science, and there might be even justification for a tier four science, which would be people once again that are not doing frontline research, that are not they're just reporting, or they're maybe teaching in a high school or whatever. In when this is interesting, because when I taught astronomy at the university level, I had to teach from a textbook to follow a curriculum that was designed by the science department where I was teaching. This was in a state university system, and I had to follow a curriculum, but also I had the professional freedom to tell students, hey, this is garbage. And this is why it's garbage. It doesn't make any sense in the real world. But still, I had to teach from this curriculum and textbook. And I turned it around a little because I had what I called a textbook study. This was done in 1991. I was at a state university system. I was teaching physics. And they asked me to teach the astronomy course, which I did. And so that was that year, interestingly enough, when I think it was about probably maybe 1994, all of the textbook companies, there were about 21 of them actually, I was surprised, came out with new textbooks for university level astronomy. So all of these salesmen are in my office, they buy my book, buy my book for your class. And so their job was to go around and hit all of the college astronomy teachers and try and get them to buy their books. And they were all different levels, like for general education requirement astronomy textbook, or all the way up to very advanced ones for advanced physics students. And so I thought, I have a chance here to get all of these textbooks And so I said, I ordered one of each one of them. I said, because I could get the teacher's sample, along with a teacher's aid, a book that actually helped the teacher go through and maybe had test problems. And it was a teacher's guide that went along with the textbook. So I get 21 of these. And at the same time, the university system was giving grants for instructors, professors, faculty, to develop videos, educational videos, with this funding. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to do that. So I took my 21 textbooks and I took them into my class. And at this point, I had about 90 students in the astronomy class. And I put them in groups, two or three students in, or four students in a group, something like that. And each group got a subject, like Venus or Jupiter or galaxies or some astronomical topic. And I said, I want you to go through all of these textbooks and take your topic and compare what they say about Venus. So these people would go through and look in all of the textbooks about everything that was related to Venus, because they had an index where you go to the back of the book and you'd say Venus, okay, and it would give you all the pages in that textbook that mentioned Venus. And so they would go through and then they would compare the textbooks. And it was called, as I said, this was a textbook study. So they went through and did this. And then what we noticed, interestingly enough, is that the authors of one textbook became the editors of other textbooks from other companies. So there was this corroboration, so that every textbook said the same thing. Nobody was allowed to get outside the standard story of what Venus or a galaxy was all about, etc. So this was part of what the students did, and then they came back and that was their report, because they all had to write a report for the class. So that was their report, and then I combined these into a video that was professionally manufactured. So I had a professional producer come in. This is all paid for by the university grant. And I made a video, professionally edited. And this is mid-1990s editing. This is with VHS tapes, editing machines. And he put together this video. It's called Astronomy for the 90s. And it's actually available on my webpage. It's one of the products that I sell. It's called Astronomy for the 90s. And it was produced under this university grant system. And it talks about the science that was being presented. And at the time, the science had not changed, and probably, even though these textbooks were new, the science had not changed for, in many cases, decades. And now we come up to the year 2023, and that same science is being taught, although it was clearly patently false in the mid-90s. So anyway, the point is that the Tier 2 science, this is the science that would be taught at the university level, had a lot of really, I would just call it, bad information. And that's still being taught today, but this is why I call it the astronomy industry, is because it is maintained based on no change. You are not allowed to put anything new in terms of theoretical structure into this world. And that's where I get into a lot of problems, say, with the astronomy community, because I've just flat said that this information is patently false. What's interesting is I also have interaction with Tier 1 scientists. And I have for my whole career, 45 years now and counting. The Tier 1 scientists will come out and talk to me, and I'll look for advice, and depending on the type of thing they're studying. And the thing they always tell me is they just keep doing what you're doing. But independent scientists are not recognized. They're actually very much shunned, because according to standard rules, you're supposed to be a good member of the scientific community, and I'm simply not. When I go to American geophysical union meetings, I have a they have a identifier that you put on your lapel, and it has American Geophysical Union, and it gives your name and your title, and then underneath your association. And my association says independent scientists. I've had young people come up to me and they look at my, the first thing they do is look at your name tag so that you don't have to say your name. They know what your name is. And then they look at independent scientists and they look at me and they go, what's an independent scientist? I say, that means I fund my own research. I'm independent. I don't work for the government. I don't have any government support or ties. And they look at me like I'm out of my mind. And I've had people tell me, they say, well, how can you do science without government support? It's just like a squirrel that has lost, you know, scientists today are like squirrels that have forgotten how to forage. They depend 100% on government support for their existence, for everything they do. But anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about this on this Thanksgiving Day. Thank you for listening. And hopefully we'll pick up some new listeners. And maybe people, there'll be other people who don't want to listen. That's fine too, because that's one of the great things about this country is you're free to do as you wish. 45 years ago, there were a lot of independent scientists. There aren't really any of them left anymore, because to do advanced science today, you need research money. And the real independent researchers simply had to cave in and get money from the government. And I don't do that. I never have, never will. And that's why I'm at the leading edge of many of the topics that I study. So at any rate, I just want to give out my web pages for people that want to learn a little bit more about this. And the one thing I do is I have an amazing water filter line. If you want clean water in your life for you and your family, visit this webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. I make a unique set of products, very high quality, the best filters in the world. Once again, jmccwaterfilters.com. And my science page is jmccsci.com. That's short for jmccanniescience.com. But a lot of people spell that incorrectly, so I have a short URL, and that is jmccsci.com, 7 letters. So anyway, thank you for listening, and have a very blessed Thanksgiving, and I hope that some new listeners got some insights. The type of topics that I talk about cover a very wide range from my very extensive background going back to the 1970s as a professional. So have a good Thanksgiving and just be very thankful for everything we have. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.